a welfare net to make provision about terrorism offences, to make provision for the prescribing of organisations, to provide for orders for the seizing and forfeiture of terrorist property and funds, to provide for the investigation of terrorist offences, and provide investigation measures, to make provision in connection with overseas terrorism, to repeal and replace the Terrorism Act 2005, and for connected purposes. The final over to you, Senator.
It has the honour to move that a bill for an act to make provision about terrorism offences, to make provision for the prescribing of organisations, to provide for orders for the freezing and forfeiture of terrorist property and funds, to provide for the investigation of terrorist offences, and provide investigation measures, to make provision in connection with overseas terrorism, to repeal and replace the Terrorism Act 2005, and for connected purposes below the first time. I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision about terrorism offences, to make provision for the prescribing of organisations, to provide for orders for the freezing and forfeiture of terrorist property and funds, to provide for the investigation of terrorist offences and provide investigation methods, to make provision in connection with overseas terrorism, to repeal and replace the Terrorism Act 2005, and for collective purposes, be read a first time. Those in favour, those against, carried. The Terrorism Act 2018.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the Act should now be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, unfortunately, we are all too aware that we live in dangerous times. But this week, in Strasbourg, terrorism has struck again. Even during our general election campaign 3 years ago, the Honourable Mr. Seaton and I had to speak in the middle of that campaign, and he will no doubt recall with as much sadness as I do that we had to agree to suspend campaigning as a result of the brutal attack in Paris that year. Then in Berlin, then in London, in Barcelona, and then in Manchester. All of these great cities and others have been suffered from the scourge of terrorism in the past 5 years in Europe alone. Around the world, terrorism afflicts too many communities. And in our own lives, we've seen our own police now regularly armed with automatic weapons. We've seen security barriers going up in our pedestrianized areas. I thank God, Mr. Speaker, that perhaps our most practiced debate in this respect has been whether or not our particular style of Jersey barriers is more or less attractive. Thank God that we are able to have discussions about that. The terms of this bill, however, come about as a request from the Royal Gibraltar Police for the provision of certain powers that are available to their UK counterparts. As such, this bill contains provisions which are found in the UK Terrorism Act 2000, the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Act 2001, the Terrorism Act 2005, and the Counter-Terrorism Act 2018, each of those as subsequently amended. And the bill will also repeal and replace our own Terrorism Act 2005, and some of those provisions, and that act will be converted into new provisions in this act. Mr. Speaker, given the length of the bill, I propose to speak to the various parts and not to descend into the relevant sections unless it's necessary to do so. Although, of course, if you try, honourable members want to ask any questions about any of the particular sections, we can look at them together. The first part is a procedural part which defines what constitutes terrorism and terrorist property. Terrorism is defined in clause 4 as the use or threat of action where the falls within Article 2, where the use of threat is designed to coerce, compel, or undermine the government or an international governmental organization, or to intimidate the public or a section of the public. Or C, the use of threat is made for the purpose of advancing a political, religious, racial, or ideological cause. And then clause 2 sets out the act, namely if they involve serious violence against a person, they involve serious damage to property, they endanger a person's life other than that of the person committing the action, they create a serious risk to the health and safety of the public or a and then companies, or they're designed to seriously interfere with or seriously disrupt an electronic system, and the person committing the action either intends or is reckless to whether any of the matters set out in those paragraphs are produced. Now, having said I'm not going to go into the section, the first thing I've done is go into that section, because it's important that everything else that we talk about this afternoon is seen through the prism of the evil that we are trying to prevent, and that is the key aspect of what that definition brings to this section. And the reason it's crafted this way, so that it's conditional in nature, that the action, property, or risk must occur in Gibraltar for the bill to treat the action as terrorism. So, the territory of terrorism is not carried out in Gibraltar, even if the action is eventually to be carried out outside of Gibraltar, of course, by definition. And clause 5 defines what constitutes terrorist property, and I'm read with clause 3, property is given a very wide meaning indeed, and includes electronic or digital property, which is increasingly valuable, whether in the context of legitimate activity or in the context of illicit illegal activity of this sort. The second part deals with what is a prescribed organization under the term of the United Kingdom Terrorism Act 2000, and how that prescribed organization can become a prescribed organization in Gibraltar. The organization are prescribed in the United Kingdom, and the reason for this is that prior to designating an organization as a prescribed organization, the United Kingdom undertakes considerable work through its security services and with its international partners in its only target appropriate organization. Much of this work is undertaken at a very high level of security clearance and subject to significant confidentiality arising from the need for security, of course. And for those reasons, and as an exception to our normal practice, we've decided to accept, as a matter of Gibraltar law, a UK designation of a prescribed organisation for the purposes of terrorism. And the reason for that, Mr. Speaker, is that we are simply unable to make a proper determination in this respect in Gibraltar that would withstand challenge. And there could be nothing worse, Mr. Speaker, than making an organisation a prescribed organisation without the depth of security information necessary in order to be able to do that, without the international reach with other security services that would enable us to do that in a way that would be past-time, and to find an organisation that is so prescribed would then be able to challenge the prescription in our courts and get themselves off our register of prescribed organisations. That would be an absolutely terrible result for us to do that. Following this speaker, that an agreed question, a question has been prescribed and considers that this has not been prescribed as an organization or person subject to the provisions of the Act, needs to be given a remedy. And since Gibraltar is not the custodian of the information that can properly lead to a designation, a person who has agreed for the reasons I've set out before, is directed to make an application for deprescription to the Secretary of State in the United Kingdom. I think it's not be successful, and a new person will be able to appeal to the prescribed organization's appeal commission, which exists in the United Kingdom. And those, Mr. Speaker, are such sensitive proceedings that they are actually closed proceedings. They are informal proceedings where the interested party is represented by a special advocate. And due to the sensitive nature of the information, the limitations on it being divided and the steps required in order to maintain security of such information, it is not possible for Gibraltar to recreate that regime with a domestic regime in Gibraltar. It would be impossible for us to do this. The second part of the act is also creates offences in connection with belonging to or supporting a prescribed organisation. Then the third part, Mr. Speaker, sets out offences relating to terrorism, and there are four main groups of terrorism offences. Clauses 12 to 15 create the group of offences concerning the encouragement of terrorism. Clauses 16 to 24 is a group of clauses creating the offences concerning the preparation of terrorist acts and terrorist training, which includes travelling abroad, funding travelling, and facilitating travel for terrorist training. Clause 25 to 29 is a group of sections which provides for offences relating to radioactive and nuclear terrorism-related offences and causes 30 to 34 are miscellaneous terrorism offences covered in that use of clauses, and they include the use of noxious substances and toxic safety for the speaker. These provisions also cover the collection of information of a kind likely to be useful to a person committing or preparing an act of terrorism, and cover the eliciting, publishing, or communicating of information about members of the police and other law enforcement agencies. The Speaker of the House has retained and added to the offences which are already there under Part 4 of the Terrorism Act 2005. Section 1 sets out the list of terrorist offences that are referred to in this Part 3, and these represent the power offences in Gibraltar law to those offences mentioned in the Council of Europe Convention on the Prevention of Terrorism, and that's how we bring them into our law. The fourth part of the bill, Mr. Speaker, deals with finance offences and the forfeiture of materials which have been used to finance or promote terrorist activities. With respect to finance, Mr. Speaker, the financing offences include fundraising and other kinds of financial support for terrorism. Clause 39 is actually a specific money laundering offence that is committed with terrorist property, and will be familiar to those who are conversant with our money laundering provisions elsewhere in our legislation, whether in Financial Services Act or in the Criminal Offences Act. Along with this offence, Mr. Speaker, there are also corresponding provisions for disclosure to the authorities where a person has a belief or a suspicion that arises in the course of a trade, business, profession, or employment. And those are also dealt with in this part of the bill. Clause 5661 actually makes specific provision for court orders for the forfeiture of money or other properties connected with offences in this part, and also for the issue of restraint orders. So not just offences of money actually having been laundered, Mr. Speaker, or having been used for the purposes of facilitating terrorist acts, but also to restrain those money. This part of speaker in effect refers to an add to Part 2 of the Terrorism Act 2005. The associated schedules are Schedules 2 and 3. Schedule 2 defines the regulated sector and the supervisory authorities, and Schedule 3 gives more detail of what the forfeiture procedures are. And then Part 5 of the speaker deals with forfeiture and freezing orders more specifically, and includes the power to forfeit and freeze terrorist property and to monitor the accounts of terrorists or suspected terrorists. The Speaker, Clause 62 and Schedule 4 and 8 of the bill are linked, and those contain the provisions to prevent terrorists from gaining access to their money. And they ensure that investigative and freezing powers are available for whatever funds could be used to finance terrorism. The bill also gives all federal agencies the power to seize terrorist assets and the power to freeze assets at the start of an investigation, rather than when the person is about to be charged, reducing the risk that funds will be used or moved before they can be frozen. Clause 63 enables the minister to seize the assets of overseas governments or residents who have taken or are likely to take action to the detriment of Gibraltar's economy, or actions constituting a threat to the life or property of a Gibraltarian or a resident of Gibraltar. And Schedule 5, which is connected to it, makes further provision about the content of freezing orders. Schedule 8, which I mentioned earlier in the context of Clause 62, introduces account monitoring orders enabling the police to require financial institutions to provide information on accounts for up to 90 days. The existing requirement to report knowledge or suspicion of terrorist financing has therefore been strengthened, Mr. Speaker, for the regulated sector, so it's an offence not to report where there are reasonable grounds for suspicion. The sixth part deals with disclosure of information, and it is to be read in keeping also with the provisions of Schedule 6 of the Act, which deals with information disclosure provisions for public authorities. Clause 71 clarifies and extends a number of existing provisions for disclosure of information from public authorities to agencies involved in criminal investigations and proceedings. The gateways ensure that public authorities can disclose information which 1983 confirmed the investigatory powers included in that Schedule 7. Under which a financial institution may be obliged to provide customer information in aid of an investigation, and Schedule 8, which I mentioned earlier, also in relation to Clause 62, under which an account monitoring order may be obtained. The eighth part of the bill appears with counter-terrorist powers, and this part of the bill is divided into five principal parts. The first part, which concerns clauses 84 to 88, under the subheading of suspected terrorists, provides the police with powers to arrest without a warrant and to detain suspected terrorists. It also includes search powers in respect to premises, persons, and vehicles. And under section 85, a police officer may arrest someone without a warrant, so he immediately suspects the person to be a terrorist, and nobody in the house would expect that the position could be anything other than that. Now, when a person is arrested under that section, the provisions of Schedule 9 will apply to that person. The second part of this part, the second subpart of this part, concerns clauses 89 to 94 under the subheading powers to stop and search in specified locations. And it contains broad powers to stop and search vehicles and pedestrians in specified areas or places, which law enforcement agencies will be able to deploy as a result of the passing by the House of the Act. And that the powers are subject to a strict code of practice, Mr. Speaker. The permission of police may give an authorization under Section 89 in relation to a specified area or place where the police officer reasonably suspects that an act of terrorism may take place and reasonably considers that the authorization is necessary to prevent such an act. The specified area, Mr. Speaker, must be no bigger and the duration of the authorization no longer than is necessary to prevent such an act. So there is an element of control there, which is of course necessary. An authorization under the section may authorize any police officer in uniform to stop a vehicle or a pedestrian and anything carried by the pedestrian. The police officer may then freely retain anything which the officer discovers in the course of a search and reasonably suspects may constitute evidence that the vehicle concerned is being used for the purpose of terrorism, or the person concerned is or has been concerned in the commission, preparation, or instigation of an act of terrorism. And that's very wide panoply, Mr. Speaker, from the commission of the act to the preparation of the act or the instigation of the act of terrorism. The third subpart of this eighth part of the bill relates to stopping restrictions, Mr. Speaker. So, I'm not going to go into that in any detail. The fourth part relates to port and border control that contains a single clause, clause 100, which is supplemented by Schedule 10. And this provides for the examination power at port and borders for police officers, customs officers, border and coast guard officers. And the fifth subpart comprises clauses 101 to 107, and taken together with Schedule 9, these set out the regime for granting bail following arrest in addition to periods of detention and the treatment of suspects who are detained. The Speaker, people as a system of detention must be periodically reviewed in accordance with Schedule 9. The first review must be carried out as soon as is reasonably practicable after the person's arrest, and all subsequent reviews must be carried out at intervals of not more than 12 hours. A review officer may authorize the person's continued detention only if satisfied with his necessary on one of the grounds set out in paragraph 30 of Schedule 9, which includes, but is not limited to, the need to obtain further evidence, to preserve evidence, to allow for the result of an examination or analysis, and to decide whether the detained person should be charged with an offense. Extensions of detention must be authorized by the court by the issue of a warrant of further detention, but the total amount of time a person may be detained is up to 17 days. This is significantly longer than for other crimes, although it is the same period as is currently applicable in the United Kingdom. Mr. Speaker, the ninth part of the bill is with notification requirements. This part comprises clauses 108 to 133, and it makes provisions about the notification of information to the police by certain individuals convicted of terrorism or terrorism-related offences. Within the community, such individuals must provide the police with certain personal information, must notify any subsequent before they make an order which is in the certification requirements altogether. Just in itself, there's provision for the certification order, and the certification order might be sought in respect of a national or Gibraltar who has been convicted of a foreign terrorism offence and who is deported to Gibraltar and released from prison abroad. They might also be sought in respect of a foreign national with such a conviction who is in or is coming to Gibraltar. Schedule 13, this provision for foreign travel restriction orders which may, in specified circumstances, be made by a court in respect of a person subject to the notification requirement restricting that person's ability to travel. As Schedule 14 lists the offences in which, during sentencing, a terrorist connection is to be considered an aggravating factor for the purposes of passing sentence in respect of that individual. Part 10 of the bill deals with terrorism overseas and is suggested by the title of this part. It makes provision for conduct that takes place overseas and in part gives effect to the UN conventions for the suppression of terrorist bombings and for the suppression of the financing of terrorism. It is an amendment which I will be proposing as committee to introduce a provision along the lines of Section 25 of our Terrorism Act 2005 to ensure our extradition laws may be used in relation to offences under this part also. And finally, Mr. Speaker, clauses 141.1 contain further technical provisions relating to police powers, consent to prosecution, defences, corporate liability, etc. Schedule 15 provides several powers for police, customs, and border and coast guard officers, including powers for them to exchange information in order to create gateways between them for exchange of information. And the 12th part of the bill contains supplementary provisions, which deals with ancillary provisions to ensure the functionality of the bill. It now has the power for the Minister to make orders and regulations and provide for amendment of such or any of the sections in the Act or in the schedule. It also provides for the repeal of the Terrorism Act 2005 and for consequences for additional and savings provisions due to that repeal. A further amendment, which I will be proposing at the next stage, amends the Process of Crime Act to clarify the intelligence functions of the Gibraltar Financial Intelligence Unit connected to this new Act. Mr. Speaker, it is regrettable that we even need to have this legislation, but that is the unfortunate reality of the world in which we live. And I'm conscious, Mr. Speaker, of the fact that I'm addressing you as Speaker, and you were Chief Minister the first time that unfortunately terrorism was struck in Gibraltar, or attempted to strike in Gibraltar, also then in the midst of a general election campaign, or with a general election campaign looming. Our first duty as parliamentarians is to ensure the safety and security of our citizens. And this legislation gives our police the additional powers and the additional tools they need to ensure that the safety and security of our citizens is provided for in respect to potential terrorist activities and are stated from the provision of the 2005 Act. So, Mr. Speaker, with a heavy heart, I commend the bill to the House.
All right, put the question. Does any honourable member wish to speak on the principles and merits of this bill? The honourable member of the office.
Mr. Speaker, we welcome this bill. Terrorism, Mr. Speaker, is a global threat to our way of life, and it is right that our law enforcement agencies are supported and are given enhanced tools to fight this evil. Mr. Speaker, it is right that we modernise and strengthen our law to mitigate attacks on our way of life. As Chief Minister has alluded to, terrorism is a complex situation, and with improvements in technology, we must be vigilant and remain up to date and increase powers available to our law enforcement agencies. Mr. Speaker, it is right with increased powers comes increased responsibility for due process and upholding the rule of law, which it is hoped that this law is balanced against. It is our wish, Mr. Speaker, that no one will ever have to lose these powers, and I agree. We want to be concerned that it is regrettable that we're all here addressing this House on the question of these powers. But it is what it is, Mr. Speaker. It is certainly a reflection of our society and, unfortunately, a reflection of the world we live in. Mr. Speaker, it is particularly important that Chief Minister mentioned Gibraltar's finance centre, and quite clearly we must acknowledge that within the financial centre, financial service provision, there are possibilities and unwittingly and innocently for for financial service providers to become mixed up in terms of financing. So it is important, of course, that we strengthen those powers to deal with that. And it's welcome, of course, the forfeiture provisions in particular are welcomed. In summary, Mr. Speaker, whilst much controversy has occurred in the United Kingdom in relation to the passing of the 2000-2005 Act, particularly in relation to self and service provisions, we will support this bill completely. One question that we do have, Mr. Speaker, and I hope the Chief Minister will be able to clarify, is the level of training and education that will be afforded to our law enforcement agents. I'd like to have the Chief Minister address the House in respect of that matter. So it would be helpful to understand how the government intends to deploy resources to the RDP insofar as continuing training and professional development in relation to terrorism and counter-terrorism, and how this new law impacts on their work.
May I also ask the Chief Minister to just explain by way of clarification just a number of provisions that I'm attempting to understand. One of them is Section 71, the disclosure of information in Part 6, page 415. And it basically says this section applies to the provision listed in Schedule, the provision listed in Schedule 6, so far as they authorize the disclosure information. Now, Section 6 is blank. I don't know whether you explained that, but it's completely blank. What applies to is the intention of Section 71. And I make the point as well because if one looks at Section 71.2, each of the provisions to which the section applies can have effect in relation to disclosing information by and on behalf of a public authority, as if the purpose for which the disclosure of information is authorized by that provision, including each of the following: A, the purpose of any criminal investigation, whatever, which is being or may be carried out, whether in the group or elsewhere. Now, we then look at the definition of criminal investigation at 74. We see that criminal investigation means an investigation of any criminal conduct, including an investigation of alleged suspected criminal conduct, and an investigation of whether criminal conduct has taken place. Now, that doesn't appear to me to be limited to criminal conduct relating to terrorism. I've asked whether that is the intention, whether it's limited to terrorism criminal investigation, because of course it's wider than that. Then it will raise issues as to whether these provisions, which appear on the face of them to be wide, indeed they apply to any public authority. You could have, for example, the FSC may have in its possession some information that might be relevant to a criminal investigation outside of Gibraltar. But those criminal authorities outside of Gibraltar would normally make an application in order to obtain that information through very well-known channels in terms of mutual legal assistance, etc. So what I'm concerned about with this is that these provisions are not being used to circumvent the protections that are afforded to those under criminal investigation in our laws and in our statutes elsewhere. And finally, no doubt the answer is going to be in the affirmative, but this does take into account the definition of terrorism, does take into account recent cases that have been decided in the United Kingdom. I am thinking in particular of the Miranda case in 2016, which involved a journalist being stopped at one of the airports and had information that was confiscated from the journalist. And in fact, the court there took the view, the definition of terrorism does not include information that a journalist may have acquired, but of course, may well be relevant to the investigating authorities, but there are issues of journalistic confidentiality involved. And in the UK, it was actually taken out for it, there was a decision that basically that the government had used. And I just wonder whether the draft would have taken that into account. Rose Hinton.
I think it's a speaker. My point, I would like to ask some clarification. My point is obviously, I don't really need an aspect. I'm looking at some practical aspects in respect to the seating orders and how the seating has been clarified. I think under Section 55, seating orders used to set effect after 2 years. And under 57, Assembly and Mayors reform for resolution of Parliament. I'd be grateful if you could confirm that is the only way in which a seating order can be annulled by Parliament. And if so, would the Chief Minister be minded to add, after the simply state, some wording on 672, where the seating order must be made, as soon as practicable, before Parliament has to be made? And there's no word in my questions in terms of clarification. Thank you.
The other honourable member wish to contribute to the debate on the second reading of this case? We now call on the Chief Minister for the plan.
I thank all honourable members for their positive contributions in the context of this bill. It's a hefty document that we have before us today because, as honourable members know, what it's doing is taking existing pieces of legislation, repealing them, adding to them, and therefore replacing in our laws the tools available to our law enforcement agents. So, in addressing the points that are being made by honourable members opposite, I'm not going to be able to point exactly to areas where we're dealing already with powers that are in our laws, but I'll just address the powers before the Parliament today. I can tell you that this bill has been published now for a year, and we haven't proceeded with it earlier for good reason, because we wanted to ensure that ongoing cases in the United Kingdom, when decided, did not require us to make changes. And the land case I'll come to in a moment is already factored in. And we now think that the bill, as it is with the amendment proposed, will be an avant-garde piece of legislation which works as at today in the context of the developing cases. But speaker, in that respect, of course, it's absolutely right that we need to balance increased powers given to law enforcement agents with increased responsibility and accountability of those same law enforcement agents. And honourable members will have heard what I said about the ability to extend the period of detention. So it's not normal in our laws that anybody should be subject to detention for more than 24 hours once they've been subject to an arrest before coming to a court where they would be dealt with by the judicial branch and then subject to further detention is required, but not with the law enforcement agency being the one to make the determination as to whether detention should be extended. So, in the context of this bill, there'll be a period of up to 17 days of detention. And I think there is the best place to see how we have sought to ensure the right balance between the increase in the power of the law enforcement agency and the increased accountability that will be required. So every 12 hours, there will be an assessment of an individual's detention and a decision whether or not to continue that detention. So just to put that in context, if one is arrested today in respect of any offence, Mr. Speaker, the police can keep you in for up to 24 hours before taking you in front of a magistrate. And a magistrate, if you then decide that you should be detained and not granted bail, will remand you in custody, and you will be coming back to have that custody assessed every 7 days. In the context of these offences, although you might be detained for up to 17 days, your detention will be reviewed every 12 hours. So, not more power, but also more requirement for accountability. Because it's important that our law enforcement agencies have these powers, but it's important that our law enforcement agencies account for the exercise of those powers. And in that, what I'm doing, I think, is demonstrating our agreement with the point made by the honourable leader of the opposition, and demonstrating how, in that particular case, in its case of detention, that balance has been struck in the context of this bill. In the context of freezing and forfeiture in financial transactions, Mr. Speaker, of course, especially the right that the broker's financial services can be seen for what it is, absolutely properly regulated, subject to the international norms applicable today in the context of the extensive use of the financial system for the financing or laundering of the proceeds of terrorism. And this bill, in addition to the laws that we already have in that respect, adds to the powers available to law enforcement and the obligations incumbent upon professionals in that sector to ensure that they never fall into a trap by not knowing what the steps are when they need to and make sure that they are in contact with law enforcement agents about particular transactions. Here, finally, would be points on training and education, which the Honourable Leader's Resolution made. Absolutely, the role of the police and the customs and the Border and Coast Guard agents who will be involved in part of this, the implementation of this bill will require further training. There is a lot going on in respect of training. There's an international effort in respect of training, so it's not just training in Gibraltar in the United Kingdom, but international training and cooperation, which is relevant. And in the estimate that the Honourable Members will see, if they care to look at the parts which relate to the vote for the RDP, that there will be elements which relate to training in respect of the obligations incumbent on law enforcement under this bill. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Peaton took us to section 71. It is intentional, as far as I understand it, at the moment, the schedule should be blank, although it will not be blank for long, as I understand it, but it was intentional that would be the case, and it was the case in the United Kingdom at the time that the similar provisions were introduced, that the schedule was blank. Honourable Members, I think you'll know that it was Dave Anderson who assisted us in the preparation of the bill, who was the commissioner in the United Kingdom for terrorist matters for some time, and he had a considerable experience of the operation of the legislation in the United Kingdom. And therefore, for that reason, the provisions in respect of the Miranda case are, of course, properly factored into here, although there are matters already determined in case law. And so the jurisprudence of the United Kingdom will be fully applicable because we're replicating part of the statute in the United Kingdom, in part to ensure, as Honourable Members know, that we have a good read-across in terms of jurisprudence so that determination made in the United Kingdom courts can help us in the interpretation of our laws. But he made an important point in respect of section 74, Mr. Speaker, which I read as being limited to criminal offences which relate to the provisions which the Act is trying to deal with. But I don't think that is entirely and completely clear beyond peradventure. And he may be thinking, Mr. Speaker, not just of the Miranda case, but in other cases where terrorism laws have been used to act in circumstances where Parliament did not intend those laws to be used. And in fact, I cannot recall on my feet, he might be able to assist me, whether it was the United Kingdom that subjected a third country to provisions of the Terrorism Act for the purposes of dealing with something that was pretty much terrorism, or whether it was the United Kingdom itself that was made subject to a terrorism provision elsewhere, so especially what was in effect of this piece of state. And that is not the sort of thing that we need to be doing here. But it is true that in other circumstances, parties have tried to use terrorism legislation to cure ills, which might be ills, but which were not the subject that the Parliament that was making those laws was seeking to deal with in the context of that particular expression. And so, Mr. Speaker, I am happy to consider with me whether here or in the definition section, because criminal conduct is defined at the beginning of this Act, the addition of some words which might make abundantly clear beyond peradventure that whole aspect of this legislation when dealing with criminality and dealing with the criminality that we are seeking to address in this act, which is the definition of terrorism. And so I think it needs to be made a little circular. It cannot be left open. If the law enforcement agencies wish to have powers akin to those here in respect of more general criminality, then they need to approach the executive so that we bring those laws to this legislature and we make the decision together that they should have those powers. They should not, I'm not suggesting that they are, but they should not have those powers in respect of terrorism offences and somehow made open-ended in a way that might apply to other criminal offences. So, I just invite them to look with me as an amendment when we get to the committee stage, then I think we can deal with that issue quite easily. Then, there are other things that ask us to look at issues relating to forfeiture and freezing orders, which are the subject of Section 65 and 67. I believe that such orders can be undone also, of course, by a court, not just by the Parliament, because the court is making the order and the provision in the order which would enable the court to come back to a consideration of an order. But in the context of the Parliament, Mr. Speaker, the practice is, and in fact I understand it is invariably so, that as soon as the office of the relevant minister receives a document which, under our statutes, is to be laid in Parliament, it is immediately laid in Parliament at the next sitting of the Parliament. So, for example, if I receive a report, any report which must be laid in Parliament, the Imperial Survey report, immediately upon the receipt of the report by the ministerial office, arrangements are made to lay on the table in Parliament at the next sitting of the Parliament. I think that is already built in our mechanisms, and I don't think there's any reason to change this bill in that respect, because we would have to go back and change every bill that requires, or every act that requires something to be laid in Parliament by including the words as soon as reasonably practicable after the requirement today, when in fact that is already the provision that prevails, the practice that prevails. I don't know whether honourable members have already had the letter. I think they already had it, so I think when I spoke to the amendments that I was circulating, they have the benefit to seeing what those amendments are. And so I don't need to give away at this stage, and I therefore, once again, with a heavy heart, I'm grateful for the understanding of all members in the House of the need for this legislation, and commend the bill to them. I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision about terrorism offences, to make provision for the proscribing of organisations, to provide for orders for the freezing and forfeiture of terrorist property and funds, to provide for the investigation of terrorist offences and provide investigation methods, to make provision in connection with overseas terrorism, to repeal and replace the Terrorism Act of 2020 of 2005, and for connected purposes, be read a second time. So, the program, the Terrorism Act 2018. Mr. Speaker, I have the honor to move that the committee stage and third meeting be dealt with this day along the next year. Honourable members, agree with the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today? A bill for an act to make provisions for offences relating to the use of animals in travelling services and to provide for the enforcement of these offences and for connected purposes. The Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to make provision for offences relating to the use of animals in travelling services and to provide for the enforcement of those offences and for connected purposes be read a first time. I now put the question, which is whether a bill for an act to make provision for offences relating to the use of animals in travelling services
and to provide for the enforcement of those offences and for collective purposes, we vote in first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Animal and Cabin Services Act 2018.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this is one of a number of items of legislation related to animal welfare that I have brought and will be bringing to this House. Local animals and travelling circuses have long been a source of unease to many, with all parts of that now existing in many European countries, both within and outside the European Union. The general public and animal welfare organisations have found that ongoing concerns involve perceived animal welfare issues, including that circuses have been found to beat, starve, and keep animals in unsanitary conditions. Circuses can never meet the needs of an animal with small mobile accommodation whilst the cat travels around. There is a difficult point of whether it's acceptable in today's society to keep or regularly transport animals in order to make them perform for financial gain and public entertainment. Scotland and Ireland are two examples of countries with bans already in place and the devoted bill is based on the Scottish model. The bill makes it an offence for a circus operator to use a cause or to cause or commit another person to use an animal in a travelling circus in Gibraltar. An animal is used with its way to perform or displayed or exhibited, whether or not payment of money is required to view the performance, exhibition or display. Performance includes tricks or maneuvers viewed by the public. The exhibition includes any proactive showing of animals to the public. Display includes use in parade or deliberate positioning of animals to facilitate or encourage viewing. In relation to travelling, a key criterion for an offence to have been committed is that the animal is transported, whether regularly or irregularly, from one place to another. A circus is a travelling circus, even during periods that it is not travelling, for example, during temporary tourist stops or during the winter tourist season. And the Act further provides for the Minister with the power to designate that a particular act is or is not a travelling circus. It is only a circus operator can commit the offence. However, this includes circus owners, people who do not own a circus, but are overall charge of it, other corporations, or if no one in those categories is in Gibraltar, any other person present in Gibraltar who has ultimate responsibility for the circus operation. Where an organization commits the offence, certain persons can be held criminally liable. Those persons referred to in Section 6 as responsible individuals must have consented to or connived in the organization's commission of the offence or have been guilty of neglect resulting in the organization committing the offence. A person who commits an offence under this Act will be liable in summary conviction to a fine of exceeding level 5 on the standard scale. Section 79 confer powers on inspectors appointed under the Act and on police officers to take enforcement action under the Act. It sets out the range and extent of these enforcement powers and for all offences in relation to hampering enforcement. It also provides for the circumstances when an inspector or police officer is authorized to exercise their powers, such as powers of entry and inspection, with or without a warrant. Entry and search powers include entry into premises other than domestic premises if there are reasonable grounds for believing that an offence is being has been or is being committed at the premises. Powers are granted to justice courts of the peace to grant a warrant if there are reasonable grounds to believe that an offence is being or has been committed at particular premises, or that evidence relating to the commission of such an offence will be found at premises, and either an inspector or police officer has been refused permission to enter the premises, or they are unoccupied. If a delay of obtaining the warrant would frustrate the purpose for which the powers have been exercised, an inspector or police officer may exercise the same powers without a warrant. An officer in uniform or an inspector accompanied by an officer in uniform may stop and detain a vehicle or vessel. A vehicle or vessel may be detained for so long as is reasonably required to enable the constable or inspector to exercise the power in relation to which the vehicle or vessel has been stopped. There are other powers, Mr. Speaker, for example, to take additional people for consent to provide assistance for the inspector or officer in exercising the power. Inspector or officers may also take any assistance which might be required when entering premises. If an offense under the act consents to obstruct an inspector or an officer who is exercising one of the powers, an offense can be prosecuted in summary court and, as I just said earlier, carry a maximum fine of level 5. In England, Mr. Speaker, there was one response to this when it was published as a command paper, and I want to mention that this comes from Animal Defenders International, which is an international animal protection non-governmental organization with over 25 years of experience studying the use of animals in services. And they have written a 5-page letter supporting and commending the publication of this bill and supporting the act. And with that, Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
I put a question of any other members to speak on general principles and merits of this bill. The Honourable Daniel Peaton.
Speaker, thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, the Commission will be supporting this bill. Mr. Speaker, it is a bill that, even though here in Gibraltar we don't have, and we haven't had any secretaries for years, in fact, I am 51 years old, I can't remember. I can't remember whether there's ever been a secretary in Gibraltar during that time, probably in the 1980s or possibly 1970s, there might have been. I can't remember myself, but anything that prohibits that type of activity here in Gibraltar, even though there are not frequent, I can't remember them, is to be welcome, because quite frankly, I think that Gibraltar needs to be at the forefront of placing animal welfare and safeguarding the rights of animals, and we need to be seen as taking those at the forefront of the political agenda. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, last time that the Honourable Member brought a bill in relation to animal cruelty to this House, I mentioned the Ivory Trade, and he said to me that the government is actively considering banning the importation of ivory items and also ivory items. I think that he was considering ivory items that may be used or may be traded as antiques, which is a significant problem internationally. Often, recent ivory is passed off as antiques. And I welcome the fact that the Honourable Minister, the last time around, gave this metaphor to the House. But something is very close to my heart, and I know that other members of the opposition, but something is very close to my heart, is this question of trophy hunting and the importation of animal parts from trophy hunting. They used to come, I think it was in 2007, the Netherlands, with immediate effect, introduced the added to the list of species that could no longer be imported into the Netherlands, and that included white rhino, elephant, cheetah, lion, hippos, and polar bears. Now, you know, I don't expect that in Gibraltar there is many people wanting to import parts of polar bears, but quite frankly, it's the example that you set internationally. It's the example that we set internationally. And we are losing species at an incredible rate. In the 1970s, we have lost 60% of wildlife in the world. It's 1970s. I mean, we are facing extinction of species at a rate that has never been witnessed in modern times. Since extinction many thousands of years ago. And I think that it's incumbent on all of us that we value wildlife, that value animals, that believe that animals have rights, that we want our future generations to be able to enjoy seeing elephants in the wild and giraffes in the wild and lions in the wild.
it is incumbent upon us to show an example and the government, and I hope that he doesn't think that by my contribution I am lecturing to him. By any means, I'm not attempting to do so. And the last occasion was particularly ungenerous when he said, "Well, I'm glad that we now have an environmentalist on the other side. Where were you in before 2011 when I was elected to this house?" But whether I have been converted on the road to the Damascus or not, later on, the fact is that I really truly believe that we really ought to be setting an example. I know that the Netherlands have added a significant number to their list, but France has done so as well, and I would hope that the Minister follows through. Indeed, I believe, having looked at the legislation, that it doesn't require any amendment, but what the legislation requires for the Minister himself is within his powers to add to the list of animals that cannot be part, that cannot be imported into Gibraltar. And it would be a wonderful Christmas present if we could look at that, quite quickly. I know for the decisions that have been made in the Netherlands and from it.
That we are a recommend under petition. Is another honorable member who is the honorable Bungalian?
I want to make that just to clarify for that, for those of us who don't have as much legal training as many of the colleagues here have. If I look, for example, at Section 8, it says an officer in uniform may stop on the plane a vessel. Of 8-1 and 8-2, and inspector is accompanied by an officer in uniform. There's a specific person there to be in uniform, whereas the page before us in Section 5 says the minister made the decision I've made a note, I think I've left my note. In other places, it just says that an officer or an inspector has certain powers without describing about being in uniform. My interpretation is that he wasn't referring to perhaps, anything happening down the street. If you see a policeman in uniform, by seeing uniform, you probably recognize that person, but it could be possible, and it has been happening, a police officer who is not in uniform simply approaches an individual, shows his warrant, and therefore that in fact proves his capacity and anything that the law allows him to do. Why is there a need just in this section to specify was in uniform? As a leader is not wearing a uniform, he doesn't have the power. It could be that I'm over reading it or something, but if we say it now, it will be easier for the people.
I just think a point of clarification in the minister, because I know that the one definition of an animal being used is under section 43B, being displayed or exhibited. I have certain reasons to serve, but I know that there is the keeping a wild animal going back to 2002. I'm thinking more of humans in general, and obviously we have an exemption premises in the botanical garden. I wonder whether the minister has looked at the interaction of this bill and this existing legislation in terms of the welfare of animals in the context of exhibition. Thank you.
Any other question before I call on the board to return?
Just a very important point made by my friend Mr. Clinton, who's pointed to the keeping of wild animals, and there is, I believe, an exemption for the Church of Botanical Gardens in relation to the existence of animals. Now, I just wanted to probe a little bit further on what the government's policy towards the existence of animals generally is, because what this piece of legislation, I understand, does is to prevent that. And I think there are two reasons in the position where we would frown upon the exhibition of animals, whilst currently Companion Act 2002, which exempts, as I said, the horse from animal guardian, allows for it. In fact, there's a specific provision which relates to services there, and I just would like to hear from the Minister combining the thoughts with Mr. Clinton as to what interaction, what analysis has been done between those two pieces of legislation.
The Honourable Dr. John Coppers.
In my reply, yes, I'm of course aware of the other legislation being referred to, and the way that the Botanic Gardens is exempted because it fulfills the criteria that allows that exemption, which was done before my time in government. And this refers specifically in the context of an animal in the traveling circus, and therefore the policy would be to keep to the 2002 act in respect of everything other than an animal in the traveling circus. So I don't think that there is a conflict there. Certainly, I have been advised that there isn't. On the question of animals in uniform, of officers in uniform, and this is based on the status, and I believe that the criterion there has been that to actually stop a vehicle or a vessel, really, would require a uniform person rather than anybody in civilian clothes trying to stop a vehicle which there might be resistance to. And I think that what is meant there is that the authority of a person in uniform would be more likely to be successful. And I think that is where that comes in. In reference to the Honourable Mr. Peterson's conversion, I hope that I've played at least a small part in that conversion. And without being in any way disingenuous to him, I'd just like to confirm that I'm expecting very early in the new year to publish the legislation on ivory and pets, and that my draft is looking at how we can incorporate a ban on the importation of hunting trophies. So I'm hoping that in the early part of next calendar year, I will be able to take those steps. So,
because I'm quite active in social media with this question of trophy hunting, and I'm in close contact with a number of organizations dealing with a campaign to ban trophy hunting, accessible a number of them. In respect of Gibraltar, I asked for legislation in other countries, and I respect legislation in other countries. So somebody made the point, and I then looked at it myself, that in fact, in Gibraltar, you may not need to legislate in Gibraltar because all the minister needs to do by way of regulation is add to a list of animals that will not be especially from those animals will not be brought allowed into Gibraltar. I mean, these in France and in Holland, those are extremely expensive. Now, of course, what the minister is saying is, well, actually, we're going to go further than that, because what we are going to do is we're going to have a blanket ban on the importation of animal trophies from outside, and that includes, for example, deer, which is widespread. Those types of trophies are widespread. Then it's a really welcome by me, and my dad from the side of the house. And we really want to see if we can deal with the ones that are really problematic. And we could do that tomorrow by basically adding to the list.
Yes, you see, I'm aware. This is in connection with the Endangered Species Act, which is one that I, in fact, was involved in drafting back, I think, in the late 80s. And has been subsequently amended. So it is possible to do that, and that is the advice I'm taking as to whether that is the best way to do it or whether we need something wider. But I'm confident that we will have that done very, very soon. So with that sort of clarification, I once again commend the bill to that.
I now put a question, which is whether bill for an act to make provision for offences relating to the use of animals
in charitable purposes, and to provide for the enforcement of those offences and prophylactic purposes, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those again, carried. The Animal and Travelling Circuses Act 2018.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice that the committee's third and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree, then the committee's third and third reading of this bill be taken today.
A bill for an act to amend the Port Operations, Registration and Licensing Act 2005. The Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Ports.
I think I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Port Operations, Registration and Licensing Act 2005 be read a first time.
And I'll put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Port Operations, Registration and Licensing Act 2005 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Port Operations, Registration and Licensing Amendment Act 2018.
The Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the maritime industry has seen growing interest in the use of alternative fuels, such as LNG, although it must be said that LNG-powered vessels have been around for many years. LNG is seen as a greener technology when compared to oil and petroleum-derived fuels, and with ever-tightening emissions regulations, owners are increasingly looking at LNG propulsion technology, both in considering new orders for ships, or the possibility of retrofitting existing ships to LNG. In fact, we have one ship currently being retrofitted to LNG fuel at Gibraltar. Gibraltar is one of the most important ports for bunkering in the Mediterranean. As the need for LNG bunkering increases, Gibraltar must be fully prepared to provide the fuel in a safe manner in order not to lose our place in the market. Mr. Speaker, this bill makes a few simple amendments to the Port Operations Registration and Licensing Act 2005 in order to facilitate LNG bunkering, in particular by distinguishing between LNG bunkering and other types of bunkering. The bill seeks to amend the 2005 Act by changing the definition of bunkering to confine that definition to oil and petroleum-derived fuels only and to separately define LNG bunkering. The amendments to the Act are part of a series of measures which will be required in order to have the full framework for LNG bunkering in place. There will be amendments to the port rules in order to align the rules to the new bunkering definitions introduced by the bill and to provide for relevant fees in connection with LNG bunkering. In addition, and crucially, there will be a dedicated LNG bunker code of practice, which will be developed by the Gibraltar Port Authority, incorporating all its relevant international safety standards. There will also be new license conditions that will be particular to LNG bunkering. The Speaker, this bill also amends the definition of port operations to include several more activities in the port operation. None of these are new operations, but they are simply being more specifically defined by this amendment. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put questions, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill? About the legal
Mr. Speaker, whilst we of course support the government on policies and development of sectors and industries from which our community is to derive real economic benefits, and conscious as we are about increasing concerns about the impact of traditional fuels, such as diesel, on the environment, and acknowledging, as the Minister has quite rightly said in his contribution, the demand for the sustainable fuel, we as opposition continue to be remain concerned about the risks and safety of the development of LNG bunkering in Gibraltar. The government, in their bill, are promoting the issue of LNG bunkering licenses alongside other activities such as commercial driving, ship tampering, and tug operations, to name a few, which is set out in the relevant section referred to by the Minister in Section 2. Two questions in our review remain unanswered, and we on this side of the House remain in the dark over the government's plans on how LNG will be stored and how importantly where it will be stored. We remain unconvinced that the government has reassured the public that it has mitigated all risk to the public
and we would ask the government to disclose all risk assessments that have been conducted in relation to the location and storage of LNG. Of course, Mr. Speaker, it is open to the government to actively and constructively engage with members of this side of the House in creating a forum in which we ventilate the concerns in a pragmatic way. The government, in their usual way, has sought to drive through legislation in a way without the slightest reference to those on this side of the House and the people of this community. Ultimately, Mr. Speaker, the opposition and the people of our community remain in an information vacuum in relation to the safety of the government proposals, and therefore we regret that we cannot, in this instance, support the government's bill. In this context, Mr. Speaker, the opposition will be abstaining. It is, Mr. Speaker, regrettable that the Minister has not sought to reach out in the way that I've described, and if he has, perhaps he could obtain the assurances that we see in relation to serious concerns that many in our community have in relation to the use of energy and the government's policy to promote pumping of energy in Gibraltar. And I would take it from me that we welcome the engagement by Mr. Cough on most of the bills that he brings to this House. But I find it disappointing that the Minister hasn't picked up the telephone to speak to one of my colleagues on this side of the House to discuss with them the issues that arise here and the well-known issues that divide us in relation to LNG, functional and development. And if we get information vacuum, as I suggested in my contribution to the bill, that at least we have some form of consultation, perhaps maybe we could reassure members of the public who still maintain those concerns and tell us about their concerns in relation to this point.
Does any other honourable member know about the Chief Minister?
The world is developing how we deal with the past 100 years of human activity, and in particular, human releases of noxious fumes into the atmosphere, in particular, the ability to heat the Earth to the extent that we have. In the short period since the turn of the 20th century. In doing so, we are adopting new technologies. During the 14th Industrial Revolution, a group known as the Luddites sort of stand in the way of the changes that were then transforming industrial civilization in the United Kingdom. The names that they were given, Mr. Speaker, now used to the position of those who might stand in the way of modern technology. Honourable members of it, not the honourable women who haven't yet pronounced a certain disrespect, and addressing only those that the honourable members of the position have chosen, cannot really expect to be defined as anything other than Luddite when it comes to new technology like LNG. This technology that is designed to take us away from burning diesel. And Mr. Speaker, only this week, from an exotic location known best to him and the lady I understand is his new wife, in the sense of which I congratulate Mr. Hannon, we have seen a pressing issue by the GSD with a photograph of a vertical power station emitting black fumes which arises from the burning of diesel. And it's been pointed out to us all how dangerous that is. Well, of course, Mr. Speaker. It is clear that on this side of the House, we are against burning diesel. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, we are taking steps to ensure that whether it is vessels that come to Gibraltar or the generation of electricity in Gibraltar is done insofar as possible as technology advances without burning diesel. One of the reasons we moved away from their plan to burn diesel in the environment of the Iraq. So, I congratulate Mr. Hammond, Mr. Speaker, not just for his nuptials, but also for now being a convert to the dangers of burning diesel. I welcome him to the fold of those of us who believe that burning LNG is safer and more environmentally friendly. Now, Mr. Speaker, the honourable gentleman has said that we have not persuaded the public who he prepared to speak for that burning LNG in Gibraltar, in particular in the location, not burning, sorry, storing LNG in Gibraltar, in particular in the location,
where it will be stored. And then, consequently, then in the new power station, it's safe. So we haven't convinced the public that it's safe. But Mr. Speaker, the last time we had a public debate on this, the last time we had a public debate on this, was the general election 2 years ago. And honorable members will realize, I often said privately to friends that I thought that the former leader of the opposition ran a magnificent election campaign at a professional level. In other words, he was ensuring that there was not 1 minute of the day that he went off, and if you excuse the relative reference to the statues that were referred to around the day, looking home, in the moment of every issue, in particular, LNG. Where it was going to be, where it was going to be stored, and where it was going to be burned. Alongside having defeated President Cabrera, I will consider myself proud all of my life to have been able to defeat him in the last general election. I will consider myself particularly proud, Mr. Speaker, of the margin by which we beat him. We agree, Mr. Speaker, that by 68% to 32%, we were able to say the general public that the plan was a safe one, Mr. Speaker. Now, I think all of the honorable members have ever to wanted to have enjoyed or descended to or otherwise worked out the map. So, Mr. Speaker, it's a huge risk. It's a huge risk. To understand the decision that the public made on this question, which the honorable member has pointed to, he needs to understand that the difference between 32 and 68 is 36. In other words, by a margin greater than the amount that they saw themselves returned by at the last general election, the general public decided that we had given them the information necessary in this respect. And we have provided more information since. That is an exchange of questions in the second speaker. What we are not going to do, and we're properly get together when it comes to counterterrorism, what we're not going to do is to publish a schematic diagram of a plan to give those who might wish to be supporters national infrastructure damage. The crews is not the key to how to do that damage. And so, Mr. Speaker, all of the relevant law enforcement and security agencies and the government have made a determination that there are public reports that cannot be published about energy storage in Gibraltar in the same way that they can be published about so many other things that we do and so many other things which are critical in that infrastructure. That does not mean that something like the provision of energy banking, which relies on that critical national infrastructure, is somehow unsafe. Because we've made the wise decision for safety's sake not to publish, as you say, the matters of the plans, which is what the honorable members seem to want in order to feel that they have the information necessary. So, Mr. Speaker, I entirely repudiate the suggestion that the government has somehow failed to publish the report that we should have published so that the public might feel safer. We have made the decision not to publish some details of some reports. Because to do so would make the public less safe. That is the reality of the system. Now, the Honourable Gentleman says, therefore, they're being asked to legislate here in this area without a fear, because the Honourable Member has not reached out to them to legislate with them in this context. What is the figure? Even everything that they have said, and the head of the Honourable Gentleman has said that this in his view relates to the safety of this community. I put it to them, Mr. Speaker, but in the same way as I put it to them, that having lost the election on the issue of LNG, they should not have blindly stood by as we continue with our plan, because they had said when the campaign was through. They should have pulled themselves to North Mole to prevent it from installing the plans, but they were serious about it. Well, in the same way, Mr. Speaker, that the political hypocrisy of their position is illustrated by their protective abstention. I put it to the honorable members of the opposition that if he is genuine about anything he said, he should look to people to vote against the bill, not the same. If he is genuinely concerned about the safety issue, how could he go back and decide
Mr. Speaker, because they did nothing once they left the election by that huge margin to prevent the whole thing going on. And they got seriously concerned about this new oil and debunking because they've given themselves a whole series of panic claims that says that the fish keeps himself away by his mouth, or the fish dies by his own mouth, Mr. Speaker. Well, the fish has died by his own mouth, Mr. Speaker, because today, on something which we say concerns the safety of the community, that we're going to abstain, we give the lie, Mr. Speaker, to the fact that we don't really feel that there is any safety concern. But, Mr. Speaker, don't give us a second way. He said that he was disappointed not to have heard Mr. Gordon call him and discuss with him, and so forth. And I think him, or Mr. Hammond, who for very good reason is not here. I'm not saying anything about Mr. Hammond's answers other than congratulating him. I don't want him to think that I'm doing that. But when he said good, I assume him on Mr. Hammond's way. So, Mr. Speaker, let me put it this way to the Honourable Gentleman. In the context of what he has said, and why I'm talking to him is all the corporations will then follow with us in this heading now. Without going into what has been said privately, just in respect of what has been said publicly, we were told by honourable members of it, when we told them that we would be giving them copies of the memorandum of understanding they entered into in the context of the material agreement, ahead of their publication,
because I was the girl of Ireland who was part of Christmas. And when there was We are
and that risk has been minimized to acceptable levels. You're never going to have risk-free risk or any other type of activity of this thing. That's why we were abstaining. And that is why we have taken the position that we have taken. Is it a position based on principle? Is it a position that is completely commensurate and consistent with a position that we took after the last election? Because, frankly, this is something which is a public interest. and environmental safety groups would like to know how it is in the government wants to go about doing this and what safety measures will be in place. At the moment, as far as I'm aware, and I've been corrected, nothing has been published. Essentially, we take this very seriously on this side of the side. And we want the government to take their responsibility seriously to provide the information that will no doubt be required from non-governmental organizations or from environmental safety groups who would like to know how this sort of operation will be conducted, what kind of bodies, what is the scale of operation, which are one big LNG tanker, two, three, ten. What is the scale of operation? At what extent is this economically viable? We don't know. But we're being asked to act in the past to pass legislation completely wrong. And I don't think that's acceptable, Mr. Speaker. And frankly, I know you are probably thinking of rights and voter rights, as Mr. Speaker said. And then I'll talk about this, Mr. Speaker, is a very good group spelling as well. What a big rock, really rocks the bottom. And we see that here today, Mr. Speaker.
Is there anybody else that wishes to contribute to the Honourable Marianne Hassanau?
Mr. Speaker, I would like to echo the words of Mr. Clinton, the Honourable Mr. Clinton, in that I feel like it is our duty on the side of the House to ask the Honourable Ministers opposite whether they have worked alongside environmental groups and stakeholders on environmental matters, whether there's been proper consultation processes undertaken in the run-up to drafting this bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Call on over to the time, the Honourable David McQueen.
Let me just touch on one of the last points that the Honourable Mr. Lincoln mentioned, which is that this is more of a consultation, being asked to do something bland. And the other one is the citizen, which has in part been answered by the Chief Minister about not holding out to them once the bill was published. So the bill was published on the 4th of October 2018, that's over 2 months ago. If the opposition had any concerns in relation to that bill, if the opposition wanted any clarification, if they wanted any assurances, what is wrong with the opposition reaching out to us and saying, well, we publish this bill, can we have some clarification from the assurances so that we can make a better informed decision? If they wanted information which they didn't have, they could certainly have called us. And as far as publishing legislation blindly and this process of consultation with one of the ladies and gentlemen, the process of consultation. The reality is we didn't have to be here today. I didn't have to make an amendment for energy bunkering. We have a port operations licensing registration, the Registration and Licensing Act, which provides the license for bunkering. It doesn't say we need this type of license for oil bunkering, this type of license for gas oil, or petroleum-based bunkering, this type of bunkering for LNG bunkering, it's generic. So there is the power already to provide licensing, code of practices, conditions for LNG bunkering in the program already. That exists. Because we have the power under the Act today to give bunkering license in generic terms. Bunker license can say, well, we know that we're applying for a bunkering license for this type of bunkering, gas oil bunkering, for petroleum-based bunkering, or energy bunkering, and the conditions which are attached to that type of bunkering are this. We could have done that. And yet we have chosen to change the legislation and come to this Parliament and debate this matter in Parliament and give the opposition the opportunity of airing their views, which they are quite rightly entitled to. So this is not a criticism of the view that they are taking necessarily. This is an explanation of the process that we have undergone. And it's precisely because this is a matter of interest, generally, that we have chosen this particular process, this particular forum, of coming to the Act with a simple, relatively simple amendment, quite apart from a number of definitions of corporations which I will come to in a moment. But a relatively simple amendment that simply seeks to differentiate between the different types of bunkering, a differentiation which we simply didn't have to do. But we have done it in the interest of the public, in the interest of transparency, in the interest of having all of this, any concerns, as in public. We have done it. The reality is that it is not the government that has decided to introduce LNG bunkering to this. Or rather, LNG propulsion, not LNG bunkering. It's not the government that has decided to introduce LNG propulsion to this. That is a matter for owners. So what are we to do? Are we just to ignore that? Are we to ignore that that is now becoming a fuel that owners are interested in? Or are we to act responsibly and introduce measures for that type of fuel to be available to water alongside other types of fuels which we already do? And to do so, in a regulated and safe environment. I'll come to that in a moment. But that is, in my view, the responsible way for us to proceed. I'll give way to the Honourable Mr. Peter.
I'm very grateful to the Honourable Gentleman because I know that it's difficult sometimes getting away when you're in the middle of a reply. But you see, I can understand the argument that fleets are moving slowly, but they are moving towards energy propulsion. But actually, the imperative of having energy bunkering doesn't come to it, but I'd just like them to confirm this or comment on it. The imperative for offering energy bunkering does not come from improving the propulsion. The imperative comes from the fact that if you do not offer LNG bunkering, it's not possible to then have an LNG power station because the tanks that are supplying the LNG power station only have enough space for 2 or 3 weeks. It means that if you wanted to effectively keep those tanks filled with LNG, you have to have a ship coming into Gibraltar every 3 weeks, which is not possible. That could be the cost of that would be prohibitive. So how do you deal with that? We deal with that by basically offering commercial bunkering of LNG, and that's how it becomes. It must have been in the government's plan at the point at which we considered to build a power station that was LNG driven to basically effectively also provide LNG bunkering, because at a very early juncture, it must have been clear that it wouldn't be economically viable. It was a point that the only thing that we could have made when we were debating, when we were having a general debate on GBT, and this issue came up. And that was an explanation that he himself provided in 2014. So therefore, it can't be right that this is now motivated or moved by the fact that there are fleets which are moving towards LNG. This is pre-planned from the very beginning, because otherwise, the LNG power station cannot be run economically.
The Honourable Member talks of the imperative of the LNG bunkering, essentially being driven by the need for the supply to the power station. So let me say to the Honourable Member that LNG bunkering is coming in anyway. The fact that we're opening a power station which is powered by energy fuels, may have precipitated or brought forward what we're doing with respect to ship-to-ship bunkering to coincide in terms of timing. But energy bunkering is coming anyway and is not necessarily driven by that, although clearly that has been a factor in the planning for this particular bill, and we have it ready at this particular time. And the honourable member says, well, in respect of the tanks in the LNG power station, you would need a ship coming every 3 weeks, and that is prohibitive. Well, the ship is actually coming every 2 weeks in order to supply LNG to our power station. But that power station has tanks which are dedicated, exclusive to the power station. I know the honourable member accepts that and recognises that that is the case, that there is that distinction. But I'm mindful that the honourable Mr. Clinton also mentioned the comments made by the Environmental Safety Group recently, and those comments were specifically expressing concerns about energy bunkering taking place from those tanks in the made it clear that that was just based on a misapprehension. It was a misunderstanding as to it. I think it arose following an interview I gave to GBC, and the impression they had been given, even though I see that to be what I said, and I certainly wasn't alluding to that, but it was misunderstood as bunkering would take place from the home at the power station, and that was a concern that was expressed by the ESG. I just want to make it absolutely clear today, as we have already done, that the power station is one thing, powered by energy, that has nothing to do with the ship-to-ship bunkering, which this bill is concerned about. No bunkering to ship will take place from the tank. There will be supply to the tank from a ship, obviously, which will come in every couple of weeks, but there will be no supply to other ships on a commercial basis of energy fuels from those tanks. That is absolutely clear. I was dealing with the point about LNG propulsion ships. I wouldn't say it's becoming the norm. I wouldn't go as far as that. It's becoming more popular. It's going to take time. It's been around for many years as a technology and used by many ships. And it will take many, many years, I expect, before LNG propulsion and ships takes over as a fuel. It will take still a few years. But the question I pose is, given that that is happening and owners are taking the decision to introduce LNG propulsion to ships in two ways, as I mentioned in my speaking notes, when I introduced the bill, firstly by ordering ships which are LNG fuel propelled, or LNG propelled, or by retrofitting, as we are seeing, and we've already got one of the customers of Jibdok having worked a ship, a very suitable, but in order to carry out that conversion of retrofitting to LNG fuels. So that is coming. That is a reality. That is a fact of life. What should we do in this way? Is this one different way? Or should we do things properly in order to have a regulated and safe environment for that business to be able to take place in Gibraltar? We chose the latter. Honourable members may have done something different by abstaining or perhaps not even voting again. They will suggest that the business should be turned away from Gibraltar. We believe in business in Gibraltar. We believe in our economy. We believe in the creation of jobs. I hope that the honourable members do see and find a way of supporting this, because it does have an effect on jobs and our economy. Gibraltar is a bunkering port, a major bunkering port in the Mediterranean, with an excellent reputation. And what LNG bunkering will do is simply add one more strand in the activities that we carry out, in the services that we provide to the maritime industry. And it is not just bunkering companies that benefit from this. Whole range, whole raft of companies, a whole industry is based around it. Ship engines clearly benefit. Every ship has an agent interval, every ship that comes into the benefit. Why? Because all of that industry revolves around what we do in Gibraltar related to bunkering. We do not have a ship because simply would not be cost effective for an owner to send a ship to Gibraltar simply to buy up a few trains. Or simply to take lubricant oil. Or simply to take a few packets of cold plates. A lot of these ships come to Gibraltar to carry out bunkering, to take bunkering, and then also carry out the crew changes. Take supplies, take provisions, take oil. And what does all that do? It creates employment in the industry. It creates economic activity. It would be irresponsible for the government to look the other way, to turn any of this business away. We have to be aware of what is going on in the world. We have to embrace it. But I absolutely agree. It has to be done properly. It has to be done safely, and it has to be done in a regulated manner. And that's why I said, when I spoke on moving the bill, that what we're doing today by introducing these amendments, this is just a part of a series of measures. There will be some amendments to support rules, and crucially, as I mentioned, there will be an energy banker code of practice. That is what we define the safety standards. And the code of practice will itself lead to the license conditions. What actually what a bunkering company, an energy bunkering company, has to do and the standards that have to be applied. That code of practice, which will accompany the legislation before an energy bunker license is given, clearly has been subject to hazard identification assessments and workshops with a view to enable safe ship-to-ship bunkering in Gibraltar. And what that, those assessments, those workshops have done, is improve the framework. There's series of recommendations which have all been accepted and will all be incorporated either in changes in the court rules or in the code of practice itself. Ultimately, what it leads to is the captain of the boat and the government be satisfied that risks are mitigated as far as reasonably practicable so that we can undertake in Gibraltar this line of business in an efficient and in a safe manner. The government is perfectly satisfied that that is the case. My response with a comment, I believe it was Mr. Phillips, that mentioned the other activities. I'll give way to Mr. Phillips.
I'm very grateful to the minister for giving way, and he did speak at length to the commercial viability of LNG and how we as a community should be moving forward as the other jurisdictions are moving towards LNG as a sustainable fuel. In that context, has the Minister given consideration to the Marple IMO 2020 report, which suggests that very, very selfish fuels and alternatives is the way forward for the future? And in that context, if that is the future, how does it seem to be there's an over reliance on this question of LNG, given the fact that they're going between 3% and 6% to the suggested moving on heavy fuels, and that there'll be a so by the world fleet towards very low sulfur fuels rather than LNG. If that is the case, will the minister clarify on what basis how that is sort of resonates with him in terms of the commercial rationale for this? Mr. Speaker, I did mention previously that apart from LNG being a greener technology, part of the drive around this from a worldwide basis is what I told you earlier, the ever tightening emissions regulations. And that is happening to shipping generally. And the IMO 2020 that consults
provision is precisely one of these provisions. And clearly, we are very, very alive and very aware of the provisions of that, and still only aware and alive. And that is set of regulations which would be implemented in Gibraltar and adhered to in Gibraltar in any other or any form of bunkering. That is something that we have clearly considered, not in the context of LNG bunkering, because what LNG does is remove, from a green technology point of view, remove many of the damaging particles that are emitted. That is why it is greener technology. But a lot of these particles that are emitted to the environment as part of normal bunkering activities are actually eliminated with LNG. So it is a safer. It is a better fuel, but it has to be done safely. And that is what I addressed earlier in terms of the assessments that have been gathered, identification assessments, and the recommendations which have all been accepted and which are all from part of the further practice. I was going to end by mentioning the list of four corporations that are included in this bill, which the Honourable Members of the Legal Association and Industry, which includes commercial diving, which wasn't in the previous list. The current act provides a definition of core corporation, which says include engaging in the following activities, and the current act has six activities. There are other activities which are not specifically defined, but are being carried out in Gibraltar. So what we're doing here is more specifically defining the type of activities that are already occurring in Gibraltar under the existing act. So nothing is changing here, just creating more specificity in or updating the definition, taking advantage of the fact that we're amending the act in the first place. Because the definition of all corporations says it includes all of this, and any other industrial or commercial operation, etc., which is also part of the existing definition, which is why those other activities are being carried out today. So it is an inclusive and not a definitive definition. Mr. Speaker, with that, I have, and everything that has been said today, and the satisfaction of the government in moving forward in this direction, I once again commend the vote to the House.
I want to put the question, which is whether being for the left, Speaker, I call a division of the House. Bill for the left to amend the court for the Port Operations Registration and Licensing Act being read a second time. It is called call the division.
the Port Operations, Registration and Licensing Amendment Act 2018.
Speaker, I beg to move that the committee state of the bill be taken later today, or all members agree. All
members agree that the committee state on third reading of this bill be taken today. A bill for an act to amend the Gambling Act 2005. The Honourable Minister for Commerce.
Speaker, I want to move that the bill for an act to amend the Gambling Act 2005 be read a third time.
And now for the question, which is whether bill for an act to amend the Gambling Act 2005 is read a third time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Gambling Amendment Act 2017. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill now be read a second time. Speaker, this bill amends the Gambling Act to a third provision of the industry's canvassed, on which I am happy to accommodate. Clause 3 of the bill introduced section 23A and achieved two things. In the first instance, it requires a certain payment to be made to register payers, and secondly, it requires for a licensee maintains adequate financing to make those payments. Following terms of the VAT regime in the European Union, there is a question mark of the basis on which to apply that to online gaming services. The amendment will ensure that it is clear to other tax authorities that there is an explicit statutory requirement to return winnings to players, and that by that strength of the argument, the VAT should be applied on a gross earning revenue basis as opposed to be applied on all stakes. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House. Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the principles and merits of this bill? No. I then put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Gambling Act 2005 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Gambling Act, the Gambling Amendment Act 2017.
Thanks for the notice that the 20 page interpreting will be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stays on third reading of the bill will be taken today? Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House is now dissolve itself into committee to consider the following bills to apply clause. The Terrorism Act 2018, the Animals and Travel and Services Bill 2018, the Port Operations Registration and Licensing Amendment Bill 2018, and the Gambling Amendment Bill 2017. The Regional Legal Assistance Council of Europe Bill 2018 and the Extension Bill 2018. With the terrorism bill. There was an indication during the second reading of the bill about a possible amendment to Section 71.
Yes, I've something to propose to the honourable gentleman opposite. I don't know whether Mr. Speaker would want to
defend the defense
or appeal. You must have done that before we go into the meeting or after we go into the meeting. Because whatever the part of you.
Okay, we move into committee and then the recess will take for 10 or 15 minutes. The committee will now be served for 10 minutes.
Thank you.
Therefore, I have to make provisions about terrorism offences, to make provisions for the proscribing of organisations, to provide for orders for the freezing and forfeiture of terrorist property and funds, to provide for the investigation of terrorist offences and provide investigation measures, to make provision in connection with overseas terrorism, to repeal and replace the Terrorism Act 2005 and for connected purposes. Part 1, Clauses 1 to 2. Sent out of the bill. Part 2, Clauses 6 and 7. Sent out of the bill. Clause 8 as amended. An amendment that has been circulated by the Chief Minister. All other members in favour of inserting that amendment. Carried.
The letter can be taken as read and accepted by the opposition leader.
So, clause 8, as amended, stands out of the bill. Clause 9, stands out of the bill. Clause 10 is amended. Again, an amendment has been circulated, and this is an objection. I call the WFSS and I'm in favor. I'm quite happy.
Rather than stopping this your time,
7, closes 75, closes 3. Then final of the day. Part 8, closes 84 to 99. Start final of the day. Closed 100 as amended. Then part of the day. Closes 106 to 107. Stand part of the day. Part 9 closes 108 to 133. Stand part of the day. Part 10 closes 134 to 139. Stand part of the day. Closes 140 as amended. Stand part of the day. Part 11 closes 141 to 151. Stand part of the day. Part 12 closes 152 to 159. Stand part of the bill, closes 160 as amended. Stand part of the bill, schedule 1 to 9. Stand part of the bill, schedule 10 as amended. Stand part of the bill, schedule 11 to 16 as amended. Stand part of the bill, the long title. Stand part of the bill. A bill for an act to make provision for offences relating to the use of animals in farming purposes and to provide for the enforcement of those offences and for connected purposes. Clauses 1 to 11, same part of the bill. The long title, same part of the bill.
Very minor point. Just the heading on clause 7, clause 8, 4. Stopping and I think retaining vehicles on disabling vehicles. Well, minor type of just as I mentioned to the honourable Minister of Inquiry. Stopping and retaining vehicles, that would be stopping and detaining vehicles. We take it as a typographic error. There's nothing to move on then.
The long title, stand part of the bill. A bill for an act to amend the Port Operations Registration and Licensing Act 2005. Page 1 and 2. Stand part of the bill. The long title, stand part of the bill. Bill for an act to amend the Gambling Act 2005. Clause 1. Stand part of the bill. There is an amendment there for the date. 2017 to be amended. It's 2018. Clause 2 and 3. Stand part of the bill. The long title. Stand part of the bill. A bill for an act to give effect in Gibraltar to the Council of Europe, European Convention on Mutual Assistance in Criminal Matters made in Strasbourg on the 20th of April 1959. Part 1, clauses 1 to 3. Stand part of the bill. Part 2, clause 4. Stand part of the bill. Part 3, clauses 5 to 8. Stand part of the bill. Part 4, clause 5, down part of the bill. Part 5, clause 10, down part of the bill. Part 6, clause 11 to 17, down part of the bill. The long title, down part of the bill. A bill for an act to provide for the extradition of persons pursuant to any convention, treaty, bilateral or multilateral agreements that applied to and have been extended to Gibraltar
or any supervision arrangement or agreements which have been entered into by the United Kingdom and extended to Gibraltar and for connected purposes. Part 1, clauses 1 to 4, signed part of the bill. Part 2, clauses 5 to 74, part of the bill. Part 3, clauses 75 to 85, signed part of the bill. Part 4, clauses 86 to 102, signed part of the bill. Part 5, clauses 103 to 123, signed part of the bill. Schedules 1 and 2, signed part of the bill. The long title, signed part of the bill.
The honour to report that the Terrorism Bill 2018, the Animals and Travel and Services Bill 2018, the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Bill 2018, the Exhibition Bill 2018, and the Gambling Amendment Bill 2017 have been considered in committee and agreed to with some amendments, and I now move that these are the first time of time.
Could these five bills as a package, and then we'll proceed with the last one. So, I now put the question, which is, that the Terrorism Bill 2018, the Animals in Travel and Services Bill 2018, the Mutual Legal Assistance Council of Europe Bill 2018, the Extradition Bill 2018, and the Gambling Amendment Bill 2018, be read a third time and passed. Those in favor? Those against? Carried. Put for the Chief Minister. I move the House of Eyes, Mr. Speaker. So, if you haven't, have you put the court operation in place? Yes, that's why I moved to the House of Eyes now when you're ready. Yes. The exhibition will now be taken on the Terror Preparation Bill. Page 101. I am Clinton. Kevin Quintus.
I.
Kevin Clinton. In favor, 5 have voted against. Therefore, the bill has received a third reading and is carried. So, the chairman, you said you voted against it. You have abstention. satisfy that. They are in favour. Three votes in favour. 1, 2, 3, 4. 5 abstentions. I said one. My apologies. My apologies. 5 abstentions. 4 members are absent. So the bill of the third reading has been carried by majority, and therefore I thought that it would be read a third time and carried.
So, Mr. Speaker, having dealt with considerable legislative business today, I move that the House is now adjourned to next Thursday at 10 a.m. Because until honourable members, it is the intention of the government to then be able to deal with all questions still outstanding, and I hope to be able to conclude the session with all questions dealt with by the end of Friday at the latest, so that we can address the year and start out next year. And Mr. Speaker, conscious of the fact that we stand the travelling animal, which we can bring on the ground next Thursday at 10 a.m.
Now, we're now going to next Thursday, the 20th of December at 10 in the morning, when we shall be going into question time.